Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 14th of January, Anno Domini 2012, and you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. We're going to do this.
That was very good.
Thank you.
You have a rhyming dictionary in your head?
For this, I do. AT&T customers rejoice. They've announced that the first 4G LTE Windows Phone smartphones are headed to the U.S. in the first half of the year. HTC, Nokia, and Microsoft all joined AT&T on stage at the Developer Summit to introduce their devices to the crowd, starting with the HTC Titan 2. The HTC Titan 2 holds the title of having the largest display of any global Windows phone at 4.7 inches, and it also has a 16-megapixel camera. That's right, a 16-megapixel camera. HTC has recently focused on improving the quality and capabilities of its camera phones, and as near as I can tell, the Titan 2 is equipped with the largest camera on a handset in the U.S. In addition, the Titan 2 has an f2.6 wide-angle lens, dual LED flash, red eye reduction, autofocus, image stabilization, and a backside illuminated sensor. The Windows Phone Mango device also offers a front-facing 1.3-megapixel camera and a dual-core 1.5 gigahertz Snapdragon S2 processor. During the presentation, HTC CEO Peter Chow boasted about the blazing fast speed of AT&T's LTE network, but what else would you expect? Finally, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer joined AT&T's Ralph De La Vega on stage to talk Windows Phone and developer relations. Ballmer emphasized Windows 8 is the next development forward and said the operating system will create a new opportunity for developers. Not surprisingly, Ballmer ended the presentation with his signature battle cry, "Developers, developers, developers." So, our question to you at soundbites.org, and that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is, are you looking forward to the Windows 8 phone? Your choices are, thank heaven it's finally here, and I'm interested, and in a word, no. So far, what?
I say it's huge. 4.7-inch screen. Look at the size of the camera that for that 16-megapixel sensor. Yeah.
So far, we've got 37 votes. 86% of you said no. One of you said, thank heaven it's finally here, and I believe that was sarcastic. When you are done taking the poll, I know you will have more to say. Oh, I know you will have more to say. So if you check the little yellow box underneath the poll and click on Give Us Your Opinion, it will take you to a wonderful website. Bless you, my son, where you can then enter your opinion. And the poll question is, what will be the biggest feature of the Windows 8 phone for you? And try to keep it clean. And, of course, that's our question to you folks here. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
I do have to thank Joelle. You notice now when I click on the bell, bam.
It actually rings.
It rings right away. She wound up Thursday night for me. I was talking to her about it. She goes, oh, I can fix that for you. And she went in, grabbed the bell sound, and deleted the dead air that was in front of it. So now when we click on it, bam, we got instant bell.
Half a second isn't that long, unless it's dead air.
Yeah. Exactly. Half a second of dead air is about 4 minutes of dead air. Yeah, exactly. Well, I had a discussion about this in my class the other day about the Windows phone. And some people were saying, you know, they had tried the earlier versions, and they were terrible, and they were turned off of Windows phone. They said, look, this is the history of Microsoft. They have done this with every single device they've ever brought out. They bring out a lousy device and it fails, and they fix it and it fails, and they fix it and they fails, and then they fix it and they own the market. This has happened time and time and time again. And they have enough money to fail until they get it right.
It usually takes 3 or 4 generations before.
And it takes, yep. And so we will see, I think, Windows phones get better and better and better. And the people who have tried them say these Windows 8 Mango phones are pretty tremendous. So I haven't seen one myself yet. I'm looking forward to checking one out. But they are definitely on the market now, and we'll see how they go. So if you've got a Windows 8 Mango phone, or even a Windows 7 phone, or the old Windows Mobile phone, give us a call and let us know what you think. Again, it's 1-800-790-0415. But if you're in the 585 area code, why, then it's just 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299.
I'm almost wondering if Microsoft is using sort of the Apple strategy here by releasing Windows 8 phone interface as to how the desktop Windows 8 is going to look in a year or so. They'll get people used to it on the phone, and then there won't be such a big change when they finally get to the desktop. And that's one of Apple's strategies, the Trojan niche, we used to call that.
Right, and they've already said that the phone and the desktop are going to look the same. So that should be kind of fun. As far as that's concerned, anyway, that should be kind of neat. The other interesting thing, which I don't have a news item for, is that Microsoft is telling system administrators, we'll get to their phones in a minute, but Microsoft is telling systems administrators, start using the command line because future versions of Windows Server won't have a GUI.
Hmm.
And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Most server admins don't use the GUI anyway, do they?
Well, they don't like to use the GUI to begin with, but more importantly, and this is a problem even Apple has, the GUI takes a lot of cycles. It takes a lot of power.
Well, you should explain the difference between using command line versus a GUI for some folks.
Right, right, right. The GUI, the graphical user interface, is all the stuff you click on. It brings up the windows with menus. You click on the menus. You do all those things. It's the stuff you do on your desktop every day. But on a server, you're almost never at a desktop. If anything, you're in another room or probably another building, and you're logging in remotely where you're not going to get a desktop anyway. You're at the command line, as if you were to bring up the CMD. If you were to hit start and in the box type CMD and hit enter, you'd come to a command prompt. And you can do all kinds of wonderful things from there, but most people don't know how to do that, including system administrators on Windows machines. And Microsoft is telling them, yeah, you're going to have to learn, because the reality is we're going to be doing no more GUI for servers, because the GUI takes an awful lot of processing power. And good administrators, real administrators, get a little porky about the fact that computing cycles that really should be going toward running their servers are running a graphical user interface that nobody uses. And so Microsoft has finally heard from their administrators and seen the light, and the next versions of the Windows server version, the GUI will be optional, and after that, it will simply not exist anymore. So you'll be back to the DOS command line. Of course, it's not DOS anymore. It's just the server command line, I'm sure. All right. Back to the phones. We have Carl from somewhere in Pennsylvania. Carl, where are you calling from?
Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
Pottstown.
How many folks call us
Pottstown?
Pottstown.
Pottstown. Yeah, that's what I thought, because that's the one that comes up. Okay, what's up, Carl?
Well, I have two totally unrelated questions. First one is...
Can we give you two totally unrelated answers? That is to say, the answers are unrelated to the questions you're asking.
I hope they're related. But I have a 10-year-old computer with only 512 meg of RAM. So my question's about slowness, but I think that part of the slowness is being caused by something other than what I just mentioned. The reason is because the computer was a lot faster when I first bought it.
Aren't they always?
The same amount of RAM back then.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example of what I mean. I'll bring up a sign-on screen that'll require a username and password.
Mm-hmm.
I'll look down at the keyboard. Yep. I'll type in either the username or the password. I'll look up at the screen, and the password field or the user field is blank.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 20 seconds, it appears.
Yep.
After I typed it.
Yeah.
Something like that. For example, I might have a web browser with two tabs open, or, you know, one tab is up and one tab is not. I'll click on the second tab, and the page associated with the second tab won't appear for maybe 20 seconds, and then part of it will come up. Mm-hmm. Another minute later, another part of it will come up. Another minute later, the border around the page will come up.
Yeah, yep, got it, got it.
What's happening, though, and I can tell you right now, because I see it daily in my line of work, is what happens is yeah, the machine is fine, but here's a couple things that have happened. One, you know, like you said, it is getting a little older. You've done some updates, most likely, to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's other software that's now getting loaded into there. And the thing that is as you do these updates, a lot of these updates think, oh, you have the latest and greatest in processors and memory and speed and everything else. Whereas on a machine that was running, you know, fine with the older software, now all of a sudden it's got this high demands that the software is expecting, and your machine just doesn't have it. It works fine, but it slows down, and it's due to these updates.
And also, it could be cruft that leaks in from installing and uninstalling programs over the years. And many times, we're just asking our computers to do more. You know, 10 years ago, no one was watching video on the web or editing, you know, big photos. So that can also be part of the issue. The problem you're going to run into is that RAM for old computers is actually getting more expensive as they are making less and less of it. And you may need to check the manufacturer to see how much RAM the computer can take. You know, a 10-year-old computer may only be able to take 1 gig or more.
Right.
So you may want to go through and dance the security tango, make sure it cleans out all of the temp files, all of the temporary download files, plus any malware you might have running. Because it could just be there's too many things running, so that you're seeing this slowdown and disconnect between when you type and when the text actually shows up. You can open the process viewer on the computer or activity monitor on a Mac and see what it's running and sometimes be able to find out where your processing speed is going or your memory allocation is going.
How much? You've got 512 meg of RAM. What's the processor?
Processor is 2.4 gigahertz.
Yeah. What do you do with this machine?
Nothing that would be very intensive. I have some things in it, such as text-to-speech, but these things happen when that's not even running, for example. When it happens, I normally only have up, the web browser, and not a whole lot else. Maybe a Windows Media Player. And maybe AOL, that's about it.
Well, both of those will certainly take up a lot of processing. But I think Steve and Dave are right. It's just simply getting old. As you get, if you were to completely wipe the machine out and reload the original XP on it, it would probably be fast again. However, of course, you'd want to go through all the updates to make sure it's still secure, which would slow it back down again. Because, as these guys said, there's just more stuff being loaded. It assumes you've got a faster processor, so it's not really as efficiently written. And that's been a problem forever and ever. Now, if this is not a machine you use every day or you're interested in being a little adventurous, you might want to try a version of Linux, like Damn Small Linux, at damnsmalllinux.org. And that would... Or Puppy Linux, actually, which is also pretty small. But in 512 meg of RAM, Damn Small Linux will run entirely in memory and still give you 256 meg of RAM to fool around in. So it's pretty fast. It's pretty fast. And so, you know, if you're just interested in looking at something that will make the system faster, and Puppy does the same thing, in fact, 256 meg with OpenOffice in it. Either Damn Small Linux or Puppy Linux would be a pretty fast alternative. And you can browse the web and you can play music and you can do all of that stuff with different programs, but still do the same things.
Okay.
The other thing that to check is how much free disk space you have on the hard drive. A 10-year-old computer might only have an 80-gig
right.
hard drive,
right.
and it may be full, and you're running out of swap space.
Right. It is 80 gig, and it's 5/8 full.
Yeah, that's
5/8 full.
Just over half.
In other words, it's crammed.
50 gig is what
you're
saying.
I didn't think 5/8 was that bad, but maybe it is.
No, you still got 30 gig free.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, though, is the way Windows does their math in determining the temp space that it needs.
Right.
I think it was a bad Microsoft programming party that they went to, and they came up with this stupid figure out of the party that, you know, takes an ungodly amount of space that it really doesn't need, but Microsoft figures, oh, we're going to take it. And they do, and it slows things down.
But, you know, there's really no answer. A 10-year-old computer is indeed a 10-year-old computer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much you can do to make it faster other than change out your operating system. That's really it.
Well, if you want to see it run fast, you just tie it to the back of your car and you go up the street. Man, will that thing go fast.
Exactly.
Bouncing all over the place.
I don't know if it's even worth it, but I thought of putting more memory in it. Then I thought, well, maybe I'll just get a new computer. So,
well, as these guys said, having more memory is fine. That might help, but it depends on how much you can put in. And also, mm-hmm. it's not going to be cheap.
Yeah.
It's really not going to be cheap.
Just bite the bullet and go for a new one.
Okay.
And play with the old one with Linux and see what you think.
Yeah.
Okay, one more quick question then.
Okay.
I understand cell phones. I hear a lot about cell phones running a standard called LTE. And before that, I heard a lot about something called HSPA. I'm wondering, are they alternatives to each other, or are they two totally different things?
Go ahead.
Like I said, they are alternatives to each other on different networks. Right now we have on the 3G network, there's the GSM standard that AT&T and T-Mobile use, and they are using HSPDA, I think that's the right acronym. And then there's the CDMA network that Verizon and Sprint use, and they're using EVDO. I guess we'll continue with the acronyms after the break.
Yep, hang on, stay on the line there. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Carl from Pottstown, PA, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, right here on the truly magnificent, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we're in acronym heaven with Carl from Pottstown, PA. You still there, Carl?
Yes, I am.
All right, so 3G is what we're currently in between GSM and CDMA. GSM is the global service for mobile communication, so that's used in most of the rest of the world. CDMA is mostly only used in America. Everyone always wants their stuff faster, so what the GSM group has done is they've used the HSDPA, high-speed downlink packet access. I found the acronym on Wikipedia.
Very good.
And they've enhanced that into high-speed packet access, HSPA. Some people are calling that 3.5G. 4G is the next generation telephone technology, and LTE is the current leader in what 4G will become. There's been no official ratification yet of 4G. Both the GSM group and the CDMA group have been adopting LTE as their 4G network. Nextel, before they merged with Sprint, were using something called WiMAX, and so Sprint had a different 4G technology they were using called WiMAX, and they have also since said they're going to shift over to LTE. So one of the benefits of everyone using the same network is that you can buy any phone and use it on any network. Right now, if you buy an AT&T phone, you cannot use it on the Verizon network because they're completely incompatible technologies. So everyone is just trying to get faster and faster. So HSPA you're hearing about now is a faster version of 3G, but it's not really 4G yet.
Is that any of that clear at all?
Yeah, that was very informative. Thank you for explaining that to me.
All right, thanks, Carl.
Thank you.
How's the weather down in Pottsville? Oh, he's gone.
There's an even faster version of HSPA called HSPA Plus. That the iPhone is using that on the AT&T network. I think they're calling that 3.8G. And especially with the iPhone 4S, the redesign, they have three antennas in it. It can use one antenna to send and one antenna to receive.
That's nice.
Or if you're doing a lot of downloading, it will take two antennas for receiving. And so it can double its download speed. And so even though it's technically only a 3G phone, it can get 4G speeds if you're doing internet-only downloading. So that was one of their features they put out in the new 4S.
Very nice. I actually ran a speed test on my 4G phone with Verizon. 17 meg down.
That's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous
for a phone. Yeah, I know.
It really is. So I don't worry about anything else. I just use my data because I'm still grandfathered in, thank God.
Well, that's the other thing with LTE is the voice communications are actually data. They're VoIP.
Yep.
So that with current cell phones, there's actually two channels. There's your voice channel and your data channel. And they're both limited in their capacity. With LTE doing voice over IP, everything is data. And so that's one of the reasons why data can be so fast is we're using all of the radio channels for data.
Right. All right. Our next caller is Ted from Fairport, New York. Welcome, Ted. What's your question?
Hi, guys. I'm having a blue screen of death issue. I have a computer that I dual boot with Windows Vista and Linux Mint. Under Mint, computer runs fine, so I realize it's not a hardware issue. When I run Vista, if I have it hooked up to the internet, it's an instantaneous blue screen of death. If I start the computer with the network cable unplugged, it starts up fine. As soon as I plug the network cable in, blue screen pops right up.
Sounds like you got a root kit.
I have tried. I ran the Security Tangle. I started up in safe mode without networking, and I could run virus protection won't load, but the other two programs, the adwares, those run, and I ran those, and there was no problem with those. I ran a virus protection through Linux. I started up Linux and downloaded the latest AVG and all that, and that came back clear, too.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Linux stuff doesn't talk to the Windows stuff.
Right.
So it won't necessarily read the Windows side unless you point it specifically at that second volume
It read that volume.
Oh, you did that. Okay.
Yes, I did.
And it didn't find anything.
But they won't always find the rootkit.
Yeah, the AV files don't necessarily find rootkits. You need special anti-rootkit software.
Yeah, there's other stuff out there that we're using nowadays that... and I'm sorry, I won't mention it because I don't want to be responsible if something further gets messed up with the machine.
Because rootkits embed themselves in the root of your hard drive and the root of the operating system such a low level down that oftentimes when you try to remove the rootkit, it prevents Windows from running completely.
We have to usually pull the hard drive and go at it that way, put it on our test bench.
Yeah,
I've gotten, matter of fact, just yesterday I had to... grab one. It was a law firm, and they were really in dire straits, you know. And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll come and get it." But yeah, because they wanted me to clean it there, and I says, "I can't. I've got to pull the hard drive." Here, now listen to this, though. They said, "Well, can't you just take the hard drive, and leave the machine?"
Sure.
Yeah, I can do. Yeah. What are you going to do with this? Yeah.
And then you'll get a panicked phone call. My computer won't turn on.
Yeah.
Yes, that's well. Actually, it will turn on.
Yeah,
it'll say
it won't boot anything.
It'll say no operating system found.
They didn't think that one out, and I had to laugh. You know.
From the tech side of things, I love it when the error messages are correct. No operating system found. Yes, that's correct. Thank you. Because I took the hard drive out.
So go ahead.
Thing that I may have, it's got to be in something that I downloaded somewhere along the way.
Here's the thing. These rootkits, there's quite a few of them out there right now. You could be going to legitimate websites.
Yeah, they sneak in. You don't know they're downloading.
Yeah, they've got what they call hover downloads. In other words, you could be going over a section because these guys will plant the code in there, and they know an area where you're going to kind of move the mouse around. And the minute you hit that area behind the scenes, it downloads it. Behind the scenes, onto your machine, and you're infected.
And it may have come from an ad that was displaying on even say Facebook page.
Yep.
But yeah, there are anti-rootkit programs. AVG has one themselves, but they can be dangerous to run because they're mucking with the root and the kernel.
Yep.
Oftentimes, if you can, as Dave said, remove your hard drive and run it on a different Windows computer, as say the D drive or the E drive, that can often find things. But again, the AV software and even some of the anti-malware software can't find rootkits.
Right. We've got one out there right now that is so nasty. The only thing we've been able to do is back up the data and reinstall the operating system.
I guess that's my question. If I sign in through the Linux partition and I hook up a external drive and I drag everything, all my files from the Windows partition on it, am I going to be dragging over the rootkit too? Will the rootkit be safe at that point?
Well, you might be dragging it over. Here's the deal. The rootkit itself is active in the root files, in the boot files. But the trigger program, the Trojan that it was originally downloaded, might be in among your documents. Now, one thing you can try, and a couple of people in the forum were also mentioning this. Anoid was mentioning it. There's a program called F-Secure, f-secure.com. They have a Linux-based removal tool that actually will remove rootkits, apparently.
The F-Secure Blacklight Rootkit Elimination Technology?
Yes, that's the one. And there is a try before it is a commercial product, but there is a try for free button. If you were to, there are also some free online tools, which I just noticed.
I found a website called antirootkit.com that has lists of all the software, reviews of all the software they know about.
But with words of caution.
Yep.
Be very careful.
Make sure make sure you have a backup of your data. You may want to skip backing up your downloads folder. And in fact, going even back a step, create a downloads folder for everything you download from the internet. And then put it in that one folder, so then you can skip backing up that folder, and theoretically that may be where the downloads come from.
See, what I normally do is have everything download to the desktop. From the desktop, then I move it, if I really want it, to a download folder. And I can organize in the download folder whether it's a particular download, that whether it's, say, hardware drivers versus this program or that type of programs. I create separate folders within the download folder so they're organized, because you know, you get that download folder and you see all these names and they're going, what the heck was
install.exe.
Yeah. Yeah, what was that for? But if I have it in a folder that says, for, screen captures type of software, right, or tools, it means a little more to me.
I guess the only files that I'd really want to get off of there are some photographs that I have and things that I've put on there, not things that I've downloaded.
Yeah, if you can look in, copy my documents and my pictures, that should be safe.
Mm-hmm. That should be safe.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
The stuff I've downloaded, I can download again. I'm not worried about that.
Yep. Right. And then my suggestion would be for all of those documents and pictures, you run them through whatever you've got for antivirus on Windows.
Okay.
Maybe use that F-Secure program as well,
right.
And then once you get Windows running again, before you bring them over to your machine, leaving them hooked up on that external drive, do a scan of that drive with the Windows tools. Once you get your Windows machine running again,
okay,
got it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
There you go.
You're welcome. I've always wondered if the antivirus programs that you run in one OS will see viruses meant for another OS.
They should.
Yeah.
So
I run AV on my Mac. Does it find a Windows virus that might have come from a Word file?
Yes, I think that's true. For example, Clam AV essentially uses the same definitions, whether you're using Clam AV, Clam XAV, or the Windows version, the Linux version, or the Mac version. So it uses the same files, so it should find the same files.
So theoretically, you run the Windows version, it would find the Mac virus that accidentally downloaded it.
Yes.
I never can find it say that anywhere, though. I want it to say, yes, the Windows version finds the Mac virus, and yes, the Mac version finds the Windows virus.
Yep. You would certainly hope that. But you're right, I don't know that for a fact. Be nice. We'll take a look at that. I don't know that I'll get to it today, but we'll take a look.
What's that? There's a virus test file. What's the name of that? it isn't really a virus, but all the AV companies have put it in their definition. So
right, so
so they use that to test an AV program with.
Right.
Someone will know that in the chat room.
And then somebody will, if we can test that against all three.
Right. And I'm also guessing some real virus writer has written a virus with that name.
On the other hand, when I was teaching security, I had a couple of live viruses.
ICAR. E-I-C-A-R.
Right. But I had a couple live viruses that we would put on test machines that I could wipe out, and the students would see how they work and how to kill them. And I still have those files on my Linux machine, and every single day when my system does its 3 a.m. scan, it's a Linux version. It's ClamAV, and at 3 a.m. it always tells me, oh, I found three viruses on your system, and it finds those three files.
So at least it works that way.
So it works that way.
I would expect the Linux version to do that.
Yes, I would. Yes, you would.
Yep.
All right, our next caller is Sue from Macedon, New York. Welcome, Sue. What's your question?
Well, I have a laptop that has a built-in webcam, and I use it to Skype my granddaughter, and all of a sudden the camera lights up, but she can't see me. I can see them.
Do you have any other webcam software you can try?
No, I guess if it's the webcam, my option is just to go buy
For the first step is hardware or software. So
did she see herself first when she starts up the camera?
No, I don't see myself at all.
You see a black screen there too?
Yes, and my daughter says she sees a circle going round and round.
Trying to connect. Mm-hmm. You could try other software. You could download the free AIM video chat program, or there's a bunch of different video chat programs.
Which program are you using?
Skype.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the first thing you could do is try uninstalling Skype and downloading and installing another version. But it may be the driver that's the problem.
And how do I'm not computer literate.
Right.
I would first get the program called Revo, Revo Uninstaller.
And let it uninstall Skype.
Yeah, because that will thoroughly uninstall it.
Okay.
And whereas you use the Microsoft, and that only does a half.
Way job.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's only like 2 years old.
Yeah. It may simply be a bad camera. That's certainly a possibility. But it's more likely to be either a driver issue or the Skype software.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason to try a different piece of software like Google Talk or AOL Messenger.
Does Windows see it as a camera in the My Computer?
Yes, everything says your camera is working fine.
And if you open it from My Computer, it should open some Windows camera viewer software, shouldn't it?
This camera is built into your laptop?
Yes, it's built in.
And there's no shutter for that, is there? Anything that will close it off physically?
No.
Okay.
So I will try that uninstalling it and reinstalling Skype. The other thing it's doing is all of a sudden the cursor starts jumping all over the page. I have to, put it into sleep mode, hit the button, and then in 2 minutes, I turn it back on, and it's fine. So
yeah,
is my mouse going, internally?
Well, it's possible that there's something wrong with your mouse. Do you have an external mouse connected?
Yes, I can't use that when it does that.
Right. There's a couple of things that can cause this. Again, it could be a bad driver. It could be a bad mouse port, a USB port. Now, here's an interesting thought, though. Before we get all crazy, the camera is probably a USB camera. So if there's something wrong with USB in general, it may not be the driver and it may not be the camera. It might be the USB business. So there's a couple of things that cause the mouse to be a problem. One is static.
Okay.
And if you have somehow zapped the mouse, the port may be bad. So the first thing to do is if you have more than one USB port, try plugging the mouse into a different one.
Okay, I can do that.
Do you have a USB printer?
No, I'm not hooked up to a printer.
Okay, because we could see it trying other USB devices to see if there's anything with the USB itself.
Right. The other thing is to borrow someone else's mouse.
Okay.
And see if that solves the problem. Again, if it's static, you can try either computing in a room that has no rug or putting down an anti-static spray or computing naked. Those are the three choices there.
Okay. It's in a room with hardwood floors. I mean, there's no carpet.
Yeah, it's, so it's less likely to be a problem. It's less likely that static is the problem. But still, I would worry about that. If you're one of those people who presses down hard with their palms on the computer, that can warp the frame and cause all kinds of stray signals to happen in the mouse pad. And also, if you're accidentally tapping on the mouse pad with your thumb while you're typing, that certainly will cause a problem.
Okay.
But those are the things I would try.
All right, great. Thank you.
Yep. And one thing you can do on many of them is turn off the mouse pad while you're using an external mouse. See if that helps. We're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave, Nick, Steve, and you. It is 41 minutes after the hour. Soundbites on member supported. Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 45 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbite. Apple's voice recognition software, Siri, has prompted owners of the iPhone 4S to use almost twice as much data compared with the handset's predecessor, placing greater pressure on operators. Voice is the ultimate human interface, said Arizo Chief Technology Officer Michael Flanagan. Voice recognition is prompting consumers to use their smartphone's functions more often, he said. Arizo advises clients on how to manage wireless networks. Apple brought in Siri, dubbed a virtual personal assistant, in its latest iPhone update in October. With a few spoken words, the artificial intelligence feature helps iPhone users schedule appointments, write text messages, and check local weather. Arizo, based in Atlanta, said it measured more than 1 million subscribers across a single network in both urban and rural areas. The strain of data-intensive devices may place additional pressure on mobile operators as they build out faster networks. Verizon Wireless, the largest U.S. carrier, said this week the number of iPhones it sold doubled to 4.2 million in the fourth quarter. AT&T, which last year lost the exclusive U.S. rights to the iPhone, has been criticized for dropped calls and network coverage among its high-use areas such as New York and San Francisco. A London-based Apple spokesrobot said he couldn't immediately comment. The iPhone 4S regular connections with Apple's server to synchronize applications, including music lists, may also contribute to the data load. Operators have sought to limit their data tariffs to prevent heavy uses of subscribers, record high-definition video and images, browse the Internet, play music on their phones. Vodafone, the world's largest mobile phone operator, has shifted toward consumption-based billing to protect its network capacity. Arizo's research shows that a minority of users account for half of downloaded data. About 1% of the high-use subscribers downloaded half of the data volumes, according to the company, and the hungry are getting hungrier. An average user of Research in Motion's latest BlackBerry smartphones, the Curve and the Bold Touch, downloads about 20% of the data of an iPhone 4S subscriber, according to Arizo. While RIM compresses data, the company's traditional business users also use fewer applications beyond email. The proliferation of voice command software may accelerate as more manufacturers adopt the technology. Because this is the way Siri works, the way Majel will work, the way all of them work, is they actually record your voice, ship it up to the much more powerful computers at your place, Apple or Google or whoever, you know, gave you the product. They do the translation and figuring out what the command is and then send the result back to your phone to do that thing. So there's a lot of data involved in that. So our question to you, do you use Siri? How's your data usage? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. And you can join the fun just like Ingrid did from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Ingrid. What's your question?
Thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
This morning I tried to get online, and I cannot access – oh, brother. First of all, let me say I'm sorry for my ignorance in advance. I added, by accident, MSN to my computer – in my effort to get a new neighbor, which is one of my dogs, in a Facebook game.
Right.
So I guess I did a Gmail address.
Okay.
And then I got MSN, and MSN is a pain. And I regularly get messages from it saying it's not working properly. You need to do this other update, which costs money. When I go to tech support, I can only get so far before they say, we cannot help you unless you are you have a paid account.
Right.
One of the problems
Microsoft is uninterested in helping you without money.
And one of the problems is an MSN there's dozens of different products called MSN that are completely unrelated. There's right. the MSN internet service that you have to pay for. There's the MSN browser to look at web pages. Mm-hmm. There's the MSN chat client to look at MSN Messenger to talk to other computers on the internet. Do you know which one you accidentally got?
No, but I'm right in front of it, and if you tell me what to look for, I can tell you.
Let's start in the lower right corner down by where the
taskbar.
The taskbar, down where the microphone and the speaker. Okay. Do you see a couple of little blue people?
No.
So it's not Messenger.
I usually have a butterfly there. Today I've got nothing.
That's MSN...
Browser.
That's the MSN browser.
Yep, the butterfly.
If you were to go into...
Well, wait a minute. Do you even want to use MSN?
No, I do not.
Then
but
just
I
uninstall
it.
Go into your control panel and under... if this is Windows 7?
No, 8.
No, what version of Windows?
I thought it was 8.
No, there is no Windows 8 yet.
It's XP.
Oh, okay.
There
XP.
You go.
Go into the control panel, go under Add Remove Programs, and go down, scroll down to where it says MSN and tell it to uninstall it.
Okay. Now, I already tried that this morning.
Mm-hmm.
That does not work. And I was on the phone with tech support, and they said, if that doesn't work, you need to go to MSN support and get a removal tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's what you can't do unless you've paid something. In addition to that, messing around myself, I went to Windows. I clicked on another one of the things in my Add or Remove Program menu.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever I did has now made that MSN option disappear. So in my, where it says currently installed programs, now nothing says MSN.
Does the program even still show up?
Not in that list.
Yeah, but what about on your in programs and other type of stuff? You know, if you go to the start, go to all programs, does it still show up there as a subfolder?
The
little butterfly?
Yes.
Yeah, see, it's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I figured it was still there because it's still messing
me up. So what happens if you try to launch Internet Explorer directly or Firefox or Chrome or whatever your browser is?
That's what I've been doing. I get the welcome to MSN Explorer, you know, the welcome screen, and then click a name. You know, I can click my name to sign in. I try to sign in, and then it says the message. I'm going to get it. Sorry to hold you up. Oh, it tries. It's signing in, attempt 2, attempt 3.
Right. You don't want to use MSN Explorer. You want to use Internet Explorer or Firefox or Chrome.
Do you have a Firefox in your machine?
Not on this one. I've got my laptop. See, that's weird. My laptop and my other computer are working fine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have them on those computers.
It's probably trying to log in and dial the MSN Internet service.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things you can do is
Should I add Firefox to this computer?
Remove some things before we start adding stuff.
Where's that dial-up LAN thing? To turn it
off. That's in the internet connections.
In control panel under internet connections. There's a setting for how you connect to the internet.
And you can delete that MSN connection.
So,
I'm looking at four things on the left. One says internet, and that's got the MSN logo. Then I've got email, MSN Explorer. Then I have the
Okay, you're in application. So change all of those. So for internet, change it to Internet Explorer. For mail, change it to Outlook Express, what we're using for your mail program.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry. You're over my head. I just tried to start doing what you were doing, and it...
This is something that I think you're going to need to take.
You're really going to need to bring this machine
in. She's
in
the right place. One of the tabs is programs, where you tell it what your default programs are. There's another tab for connections, which tells it how you're connected to the internet.
Would that be connect to?
No.
Mm-mm. No?
I thought it said connections. No, nobody has a Windows machine here, so we can't find it. But you have to tell it not to use MSN and tell it to use LAN.
I got it.
No, not network connections.
No, I don't got it. Okay.
Yeah. Really, Ingrid, I'm sorry, but we're at the point where you're going to have to bring your machine in.
Somebody has to see the screen to change the changes.
It's not a hard set of changes to make. It's just that doing it over the phone this way is
boring.
No, not boring at all. But the problem is it's hit and miss as to whether we tell you exactly the right thing and you type exactly the right thing.
Yeah.
I don't want you making mistakes.
And messing up the whole machine.
Because you didn't understand what we were saying or we didn't say it quite correctly.
All right. Well, in case I can find it, tell me one more time. I'm looking for just the word connections.
In the internet options.
Hold on one moment. Internet options.
Oh, I just found internet options.
Right.
And then I see
you go to connections. Now, in the connections, you should see in there, it says dial up a virtual private networking in that window.
Yes, I have only the click-on option add right now.
There's nothing else in that window?
Nothing. The window is blank, and to the right it now, says add, remove, and setting.
Right. Now, below that, does it say never dial a connection?
Yes.
And that's highlight.
Yes.
All right. So the other thing I want you to do is go to where it says the LAN settings.
Yep, got that.
Click on that. It opens up another window, and it should say auto detect settings.
Yep.
Checked?
Yep.
All right, so you're good there.
Well, she's got it in that same window. Oh, go back there. Under programs.
Under programs.
Change your default web browser to Internet Explorer instead of MSN Explorer. Change your email program to whatever program you're using for email. So that's where she was before, and that, now everything is set to MSN.
Yeah. See, in that other tab where it says programs, down below you'll see the globe with the circle around it, and you can sit there and say, make Internet Explorer my default browser.
Unless MSN Explorer removes Internet Explorer.
I don't think you can.
Or replaces it.
I don't think so. Give that a shot, though.
I posted a link I found for removing MSN Explorer from Windows. It does a couple of tricky things. You remove your components.
Ingrid, honest, I really got to get to the point where I got to tell you, you really need to bring your computer to somebody.
Okay, but I'll look at the link.
Yeah, and I know you want to do it yourself, and God bless you, but I don't want to tell you to do something wrong, and you end up doing some damage to your system. This is the kind of thing where somebody's got to be sitting down and looking
watching
at your machine so they can also see what your default programs used to be and reset those up so you're using all the right ones again.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you, and I'm sorry we can't give you an answer over the phone.
Should we back up a step? What were you trying to do that created that problem that she accidentally installed MSN?
Well, she said she was trying to get a friend of hers on a game they're playing in Facebook.
Yeah.
And that it may have said install Internet Messenger.
Yeah, until you actually look at it.
There are a lot of things that install junk all over your machine.
Yeah, I wouldn't be comfortable. Like you said, you know, you tell her to do this and that. You don't know what else was on that screen and what else was changed.
Yeah.
Right, and exactly right. If we tell her to change one thing and something else screws up, then it becomes a cascade of problems.
See, and this is where I can't stress enough to folks. Microsoft, I don't care whether it's Windows 98, XP, Vista, Windows 7, and any other future version coming out. The uninstallers for those products don't do a good full job. They still leave remnants behind into the registry, which makes it still bulkier. I highly recommend a product called Revo Uninstaller. It's free. Use that to uninstall any program that you don't want. It, one, gets rid of all the things in the registry, and it will delete all the folders relative to that program off your computer.
Right. In this case, that's not what Ingrid wants to do. She wants to bring her machine to somebody. But for those
who are
doing
that's
this,
what I'm saying.
Is she done?
Yeah. That's what she should have done originally.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, the reality is...
But she didn't know that because Windows...
No, she was trying to help a friend. God bless her. Mm-hmm. She was doing exactly the right stuff.
Oh, yeah. No.
The problem really is that so many of these things now, I hate to say it, but particularly on Facebook, try to do a bunch of different things, add a bunch of stuff to your system.
Yeah.
That's how these games get money.
Mm-hmm.
They make a deal with MSN, for example, and it says for everybody who installs this product, you get a nickel, a dollar, a quarter, whatever it is. So the first thing they're going to do is say, well, in order to add somebody to your friend in this game, you got to download this.
Yep.
So you download it. You don't know that it's just so that they can make money, that it isn't necessary.
And it's adding so much other bulk.
It's toolbars that pop in like that, too. Do you want to install the McAfee security toolbar? No, I've got 27 toolbars already.
Right. I've actually seen pictures of machines where the toolbar takes up the entire screen and you can't see the browser. All right. That music subtly subtly tells me that we're going to take a... Yeah. All right, very good. Thank you. Too hot. DJ Skunky Dave is on the...
Rob's still on a cruise.
Yeah, right. He's cruising like a Norwegian. We're going to take a quick break, back in just a few more minutes. For a whole nother... This hour's over. We're just going to do it all again, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do it right. With Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you, it is 59 minutes after the hour. We are, some days it seems longer than others, the longest-running computer show, yada, yada, yada. Member-supported, Jazz 90.1.
Sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Dish Network used the Consumer Electronics Show to rebrand itself and embrace a more connected customer base, unveiling a new Hopper DVR with a 2-terabyte hard drive and a companion device dubbed Joey. The company also will partner with Viasat for satellite broadband service. Going forward, the pay TV business will be simply known as Dish. CEO Joe Clayton said during a press conference here that Dish wanted a product that people would know by name, like Droid or iPhone or Cher or Lassie. To that end, Dish... they didn't actually add Cher or Lassie. To that end, Dish has adopted the kangaroo as its mascot, hence the Hopper and Joey monikers. The Hopper included 3 satellite TV tuners, a 2-terabyte hard drive that holds up to 2,000 hours of video, up to 250 hours of HD video, or up to 1,000 hours of SD user recordings. The device is Bluetooth-equipped for linking to devices like wireless headphones and includes picture-in-picture for watching 2 channels at the same time. The Hopper can record up to 6 TV shows at once, 4 primetime anytime shows and 2 live programs. The primetime anytime is a new feature that will allow users with one click to record every single primetime show from ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC on a given night and store them for up to 8 days. You will never need to leave your house again.
I've wanted a VCR. I've been wanting this for a long time. I wanted a VCR like that that would record everything and then let me tune it as I'm watching it.
Yep. To extend TV to viewing to other rooms, Dish is offering the smaller companion device known as Joey, which runs a 750 megahertz Broadcom processor. With a Hopper and 3 small Joeys, customers can watch content simultaneously in 4 separate rooms around the house. If you've torn apart your living room looking for the remote, the Hopper will include a convenient locate remote button. Click it, and your remote will beep. The Dish is part of the TV. I need that because it will constantly beep in my daughter's room. Dish is part of the TV Everywhere effort, which will allow customers to access content on the web via Dish Online.com. The Hopper can also be connected to the Sling adapter for on-the-go access. There's nowhere you can't get TV now. To that end, Dish will partner with Viasat to offer satellite broadband service that boasts up to 12 megabits download and 3 megabits upload speed. Bundles, and they're apparently now talking about everything we just talked about, starts at $79.98 a month. Clayton pushed the service as a way to get broadband to underserved rural areas. The offering will expand this summer when Dish parent company EchoStar launches a new high-powered satellite. Dish will include access to several partner services, the $10 Blockbuster at Home service, which is an extension of the Blockbuster Movie Pass launched in the fall, will include streaming access to more than 10,000 movies and TV shows, including 3,000 kid shows and 20 premier movie and family channels, among other things. Sirius XM will also be available, as will apps like Facebook, Twitter, Pandora, and the Weather Channel. Does the new Dish offering, which includes the 12 megabit download, excite you? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. In the meantime, we're going to talk to Dennis from North Chilai, New York. Welcome, Dennis. What's your question?
Yeah, afternoon, guys. Okay, we got a new laptop, and you know how it comes with a very basic version of Microsoft Office installed on it?
Yep.
Okay, well, didn't feel like paying to get, you know, the full version, and so I uninstalled it, and I installed our old Office 2000 onto it.
Yeah.
Okay, now we can open up, you know, like all of the old documents that we transferred from our previous computer without any problem. But whenever we make a new document and save it, and we try and open it up, it's in the library thing. We click on the library, and it shows the document that's saved. But whenever we click on it to open it up, all it does is duplicate itself.
Interesting.
It looks as though it does open it up, but then it closes it right back down again, if you know what I mean.
Yes. There's what version of Windows are you using?
Probably Windows 7 if it's a new laptop.
Yeah, it's a Windows 7, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, couple of things. It's certainly a possibility that Microsoft Office 2000 no longer support it, but then I would expect it not to do anything at all. It is equally likely that it's just a bad install. Did you install it from the original CDs?
Yeah.
And did you take it off the old machine it was on?
Okay, maybe I should clarify. Actually, it's I installed it off of a copy.
Yeah, no. Okay, first we really can't talk about that because that's probably illegal. The second thing is if it's not the original CDs, it's unlikely it's a working copy, a correctly working copy. There are some hidden files that if somebody just copied the files, they probably didn't get.
Well, it's worked fine for years.
Okay, then I don't know what to tell you.
What may have happened is since Office 2000 is now 12 years old, it probably had many old versions of DLLs that would mess up the DLLs inside of Windows 7. Sometimes you get an error message, this DLL already exists, you want to replace it, and you have to say no. But oftentimes that means that these really old programs won't work on a really new operating system.
Right. If you're lucky, they did not overwrite the newer DLLs that are required to run Windows 7.
What your best bet may be in the long run is use the free OpenOffice.
Or LibreOffice.
Or LibreOffice instead of trying to use such an old version of Microsoft Office.
LibreOffice?
L-I-B-R-E Office. I believe it's LibreOffice.org. Steve is typing that in as we speak.
Yep.
And there it is. LibreOffice. It's everything Office is, including database and couple of other things, and it's absolutely free.
Mm-hmm.
It looks a little different from Microsoft Office, but it works very much the same. A couple of the keystrokes will be different, the key commands, but unless you're doing very high end things in Excel,
it
should work perfectly well for what you want to do. It does 90% of what Microsoft Office does. It's the 90% that most people use every day. And it's free.
And even on Microsoft's side, the current Office 2010 for Windows, the prices have dropped drastically for home users. It's $120 for a single license,
right?
Or $150 for three licenses. You can install it on three computers in your household. It's not the $500 that Office used to be for the home users because it doesn't include access is the one big thing because home users don't need a big database program. We run into this a lot in our store on the Mac. Most people are familiar with Microsoft Office, so they end up buying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard for a lot of people to switch to a different program because it looks different.
Well, if you need a database program, you can just use OpenOffice, which is free.
Right,
well,
OpenOffice or LibreOffice. Yeah. Was Libre forked when Sun?
Yeah,
Oracle bought Sun.
The original product was Sun was Star Office.
Yes,
and Sun owned it. And then they turned it into OpenOffice.
Yeah.
And now Sun has done some weird things with OpenOffice, so they forked it again, and they made LibreOffice. There's a brand new version of LibreOffice that just came out where they removed a whole bunch of the cruft that was in a dead code that was just hanging on and not being used. Mm-hmm. So they say the new version of LibreOffice is much faster,
runs
smaller, runs better. So I would at least, at the very least, you owe it to yourself to check out LibreOffice.
Okay, and is that compatible with the Microsoft old file? You
know? I use LibreOffice every day at work.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has noticed. I open up other people's documents, save documents that I share with them.
Completely
They're
compatible
all on Windows.
With Word,
it's
Excel,
completely
PowerPoint.
Compatible. The only difference for me is because I'm on Linux, I don't have a couple of the fonts that the other people have, so I have to be careful what fonts I use. Mm-hmm. On Windows, to Windows, that's not a problem.
Okay.
Right, I mean, that's the big deal.
Right. All right, thanks. I'll give that a shot.
Yeah, give that a shot.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. You're a big help.
Thank you.
I've seen quite a few customers still trying to use their Office 2000 disks because that was the last version.
That's what he was doing.
That's the last version that didn't require internet activation.
Right. Well, but as we said, the problem is there are a lot of the shared DLLs that just aren't the same anymore. After 12 years, there's a shock. And it's very possible. The hope is that he didn't overwrite any DLLs he'll find necessary later.
I came across somebody was questioning, talking about going back to old programs. Xerox product called Gem.
I loved Gem.
That was so cool.
I think I still have a copy of Gem Office on my shelf.
Somebody,
that was DEC.
No, it was called Gem, and Gem wound up, it had a host of different products, and I used Gem because the reason it came up, the person showed this flow chart. I go, yeah, I know that one. They go, oh, you do? I go, yeah, I created it. It was still floating around for this Sagittarius program that I created, and they go, you kidding? That thing was, it's been copied and recopied, and everybody's got, you know, all over the place. And I go, I originally did it, and it was a whole flow chart.
DRI. It was the Graphical Environment Manager originally created by Digital Research.
Yeah.
And then used in the Xerox Star and the Xerox Alto.
It was a great product. I mean,
it was a terrific product. I loved it.
Yep.
And the Apple II GS and the Atari, the early Macintoshes.
Yeah, so everybody used Gem. It was a great product for its day.
Yep.
Absolutely.
And that was the revolution in the late 70s, early 80s, that computers used to be punch cards and typed commands and research done by, you know, Digital Research, Galactic Digital Research.
Intergalactic Digital Research.
Yep. And Xerox PARC, that average normal people could use a computer with icons and mouse, the whole Windows icon and mouse interface that spawned the home computer revolution.
Right. All right, our next caller is Bill from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
I called last week. I have a laptop, well, actually a little netbook, that's wireless, and two networked computers. They're all on a Linksys WRT54G router.
Mm-hmm.
And, my wireless connection works fine onto the Internet, but I was trying to get the netbook onto the same network as, well, my what do they call it, the home group?
The work group or
yeah,
home
the
group,
work group.
Yeah,
the
work group, yes. And I can't. I can see the netbook from the other two computers that are actually on the work group, but I can't see the work group. Well, I did for about 20 minutes after calling you guys last week, but now I can't find it. I can print from the netbook onto the printer that's connected to one of the wired computers on the work group, but I can't find the work group, can't find out how to...
Is that netbook set up to be shared?
I think so, and I actually can open the folders on the netbook from the two wired computers, but I can't see the other two computers from the network. From the netbook, I'm sorry.
Well, okay.
Do the other computers see each other and share files between them?
Yep, and I can actually, from the other two computers, look at the files that I had, my shared files on the netbook, but I can't vice versa. I could see them once last week. As I said, I can print from it to a printer that's connected to one of the wired computers, but I cannot now see them.
And the netbook
is Windows 7, what do they call it, basic or starter.
Yeah, that may be the problem right there.
So there's some things about, they call it a home group now, not a work group. And so I can't figure out how do you discover a work group. I'm not sure how you
do it. No, what you would do is you go into, just like you go down to start, you go into the control panel under on the system. You click on the system, you go to the computer name, and that's where you can change what work group you belong to.
Oh, okay.
I always right-click on my computer and go to Properties, and then there's a Network Identity tab.
Okay.
I just found a link at Microsoft on how to share files between different operating systems.
Okay. Now it's called just Computer, Windows 7. Okay.
Yeah, theoretically.
And then I go to where? Network? Yes?
No, System.
Under System. In the control panel, you go under System.
Okay. Oops. Okay.
And hold on a minute. Here I can actually go.
And then settings, there's something there that says panel. Identity, I think.
You go under a System, and yes, you will go to Computer Name. And under Computer Name, you can then, it says Network ID. And that's, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can't even find it. They don't do it in a list anymore. It's, Hardware and Sound.
Yeah, you want to go under, it's usually down the bottom list, system? It's called System Properties, and you're going to go under the computer name.
No basic information about your computer? It isn't done the way panel used to be done.
Oh, well, you got to change it to...
Right-click on computer in the start menu is the quickest way to get there.
Okay. Start menu, go to computer.
Once you're in that once you're in that system properties, there's a change setting tab that you want to get to.
Properties, okay. Yeah. Okay, so here I am, device manager, remote settings.
And there's a computer name domain change. Yeah, the link I've posted has the specific places you have to get to change your network. You also may have to change between a public network and a private network. If the netbook is on a public network, it cannot and will not see anything on your private network by design.
Okay.
When you take a netbook,
I'm at home now.
But if your computer thinks it's on a public network, when you take your laptop to a coffee shop or whatnot, you don't want to share anything out. So check the link we've posted on our link list, and it's got a video and textual instructions on how to work it.
Okay, great.
It's also possible, though, that Windows
Thank you very much.
Starter Girls are young. Doesn't have home group
the
in it.
Odds are there to be.
Leonard Cohen. I love Leonard Cohen.
You got it.
What an artist. We're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Winning streak. And summer now.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Mike from Rochester on the line. Welcome, Mike. What's your question?
Good afternoon. I'm in the market to purchase a new printer, and this need arose very recently when I needed to scan a multiple-page document, and I wanted to be able to save it as a PDF file to forward to one of my colleagues. So needless to say, I've been to Staples, I've been to Office Max. And everyone you talk to that's an expert sort of has their own opinion on what the best multiple-use printer is to purchase. At the moment, I have a HP DeskCheck 930C that prints pictures of suitable quality for my needs, and an HP ScanJet 3970. So with all these choices out here, I'm absolutely bewildered on what's a good printer to buy with the features that will scan multiple documents, and if I have that feature, do I need to compromise the quality that I'm getting with my, probably it's an 8-year-old printer, it's 930C.
Yeah. There are a dozen decent ones out there.
It used to be that the all-in-ones had much lower quality of each piece than standalone devices did.
Okay.
But in the last few years, that's pretty much gone away. Most of the all-in-ones are really, really good. I found a article at CNET reviewing all-in-ones. They like, Epson, Lexmark, another Epson, Canon, HP. They like a lot of them. but that's some place to look at to see what an independent reviewer looks at. One of the things that we've noticed at our store is that the Epson printers tend to have a little better color photograph printing ability, and the HP printers tend to have a little better text printing capability, and the brothers are cheaper consumables. So there is no best. It depends on what your criteria for best are.
I guess my criteria would be is I enjoy, you know, photography as a second hobby. And when I, you know, take a beautiful picture or something, I like to be able to print out a high-quality print from home.
Yeah, I'd lean more toward Epson or even Canon for that. They tend to do better photographic printing than HP or Lexmark.
Is it fair to make the assumption that if I see tiny printer cartridges on a printer, that maybe when it's printing photographs, it's using the minimal amount of ink required and maybe not the best quality?
Never make that assumption. Mm-mm.
It's more likely the assumption is they wanted a cheap cartridge, so there's less ink in it. So it may be a $10 cartridge, but you're going to change it way more often. The bigger the cartridge is, the lower the cost of ink becomes, because you can get more ink out of your cartridge before you replace it.
Certainly. And I also noticed that some of them have dual black cartridges, one black cartridge for printing documents and then the second black cartridge for the photographic application.
Yeah, they'll have black and photo black. Epson even has a model with three blacks. There's light black and light black, mostly geared toward black and white photography,
right,
where you need those subtle shades of gray. Yeah, I would call it gray, but they call it black and light black.
Right.
You'll also find that some printers, again, especially in the Epson brand, will have six colors in addition to the regular cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. They'll often put in a light cyan and a light magenta to give it better photographic printing with those extra colors.
Well, like my art teacher used to always say, black is just the absence of light, and anything thereof is just various of more light being applied to it.
Right.
And
you also want to make sure that when you buy these printers, you buy something with separate cartridges.
Yeah.
That kind of made sense to me, because you may tend to go through your red or your blue more often than other colors.
Yeah, when my daughter was a kid, she had her blue period.
Yep.
She would print out entire pages of blue.
Since printer cartridges are cyan, magenta, and yellow, there is no blue, so it's got to mix two colors to get blue. Although there's, again, I go back to Epson. There's an Epson printer. It's got eight colors in it, the standard CMYK, and then it has red, green, blue. Is that seven? And then it has a gloss cartridge. So it actually prints a glossy coating on top of your photograph when you're done with it.
Sweet.
I did get that information shopping around, that the salespeople generally said Epson.
Yeah.
You tend to want to print a lot of photographs. At the moment, I still need that capability where I can scan a multiple-page document. And I guess if Epson has a printer that fulfills both those needs...
Well, then you just get yourself a rack sit there and stack up the printers.
Yeah.
Epson has its Workforce series, which has sheet feeders on the scanner. And then there's the Artisan series... we sell a lot of those because they have the six and eight colors. And I'm pretty sure there's an Artisan that has the sheet feeder on it also. A lot of the all-in-ones is just one sheet at a time. So having that multi-sheet feeder allows you to feed in multiple paper to scan it at once.
Yeah, that's important to me, especially because sometimes I need to scan the whole document as a single PDF file.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on Kodak's color printing technology, where they... wind up using smaller color cartridges. Is the performance or the quality of their photographs notably different from Epson?
I haven't been able to look at the Kodaks that much. They don't sell through distribution channels. They're only through regular retail channels.
Yeah, I know the lower-end model, they were having some issues, but I think those have been corrected. I know the higher-end one is phenomenal. I've got a few clients that have been using the higher-end one, and... yes, supposedly they get more out of a cartridge.
Yeah, that's one of the Kodak's big thing is cheaper ink. So then they may have slightly bigger cartridges, or the ink itself is a little bit cheaper than some of the other brands. Someone once calculated, you pay like $10, $12 for that little tiny ink cartridge. That's like $4,000 a gallon.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. but the Epson Artisan 800 series, so the 810, 820, whatever that is.
837 is the current model.
It should have feeders.
Yeah, it's got a sheet feeder.
Multi-document feed. Multi-sheet feeders.
Yeah, automatic document feeder, some places call it.
Do you have an idea what the Kodak high-end printer is that does these multiple functions that's affordable for home use?
Wasn't that the ESP9, was it? The high-end?
Yeah. I don't have a computer that I can search on, even though I've got three keyboards mice here in front of me.
Kodak, it's the new Hero brand in Kodak. They have the Hero brand and the ESP brand. And I'm not sure what the difference is between them. There's more Heroes than there are ESPs.
Well, it's good to hear you guys are as confused as I am.
The Hero 9.1 tends to be, it looks like it's their highest-end printer. Most of these printers, too, in this range have the have Wi-Fi built in, which is nice. And a lot of them also will have Google Cloud Print built in or HPE Print built in or the Apple AirPrint built in. So you can also print wirelessly from your tablet or iPad.
Are these functions that you might want Windows 7 for instead of XP?
You should probably move to the latest one. There may not be drivers for new printers under XP.
That's an added...
Honestly, nobody's making any drivers for XP anymore.
That's an added thing to look at when you're looking at a spec sheet on a printer, what system version it supports, and does it have XP drivers?
Thanks. I wouldn't have thought of that at all. I recently purchased a new computer from Dell, and the reason I stuck with XP is I have a professional Kodak camera, and Kodak software, which is no longer supported for this camera, only runs on XP and Vista.
Right. So if your first thing to do then is to take a look at whether or not there's an XP driver, because
the Kodak
Hero 9 don't have them.
Kodak Hero 9 does.
There you go.
Let me see if the Epson Artisan does also.
Somebody told me that there's something called Windows Ultimate that has an XP mode on it.
Well, kinda.
You can run virtual Windows.
Yeah,
I mean, if you went to Windows 7, and you could still run Windows XP in a virtual mode.
I did. I actually tried that because the first computer I got from Dell was, I think, their E6510, which I was really happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get the Kodak software to run in the XP virtual mode.
Yeah.
However, it didn't see a lot of the accessories on my computer, like my internal graphics card. And
That's why I say kinda.
Yeah.
And then
Quasimodo.
Right. And I also use a program called SolidWorks, and unfortunately, my license is for a 2007 version SolidWorks, and that doesn't seem to work so well on Windows 7 as well as it works on XP. So,
right.
A little afraid of just leaving my XP as yet.
No, I absolutely understand that. And if you're not at the point where you can do all the upgrades that are necessary, then you really need to find a printer with XP drivers.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, as far as Windows Ultimate goes, it really has an XP virtual mode.
Kinda.
Okay, so if I was to spend the money on Windows 7 Ultimate, don't expect that it would see my graphics card and a few other things.
Well, don't expect that it'll work quite as well as XP would by itself.
Okay.
And don't forget, if you're going to load a program into XP, it's going to want those XP drivers, and it'll do some translation back and forth inside and outside of 7 Ultimate. But, like any train, you can get lost in translation, right? So you want to be very, very cautious about what you run, and the more esoteric something is, the less likely it is to run correctly.
Okay. Well, you folks have been very helpful. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
That's scary that we actually have helped another one. Wow.
We have to cut that nonsense out. I think we've that may be the second person we actually helped today. I don't know that that's good for our reputation.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about that, but thank you. We're happy to help. If we did that, that'll be kind of unusual for us. Let's see if we can do it again, shall we? We have another caller on the line, and this would be Joe from Pittsford, New York. Welcome, Joe. How can we screw up your day today?
Hi, guys. I have been asked to look into the possibility of streaming video from multiple classrooms over the Internet. And I know that you guys use Ustream, and I was wondering what's involved and whether this is something that would be workable.
Ustream, well, we are using Ustream. Mm-hmm. Even as we speak, we're using Ustream.
Yes, I understand that.
One of the nicest things with Ustream is it was free.
Right.
And
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Nope.
If you get up above 50 simultaneous streams or something like that, you got to go up to the pay version.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically intended for one stream at a time. So if you want 10 classrooms to be able to stream, you'll have 10 different accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could have one account in 10 channels. They call it a channel.
Okay.
It's basically free, so it's easy to try and play with to see if it works for you or not.
Is it wide open, or can you limit it to like registered students?
I don't know. Let me see. There's an advanced settings button down here. I would assume there's a way to do private.
I bet you they locked that down, though, for paid version.
That might be only be in the paid
mm-hmm.
version.
Mm-hmm. I would think also, what do you think you could get four streams out over a standard Roadrunner connection?
Now, because it's up.
Up, yeah.
Right? You're doing streaming up, and that's 384K, so it's going to be slow.
Yeah. I've got 9 streams running now on our DSL. Actually, we've opened a new store in Webster, so I have 3 security cameras running there to our Victor store, and I can view them all remotely with the 6 cameras we have at Victor. So I've got 9 streams running simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, but is it a little slow?
Yeah, 2 or 3 frames a second.
Yeah, see, exactly. That's the problem.
Right. We couldn't have what would look like real live video. Probably.
And, not
that many streams at once on a standard. You can probably get, you can buy anything you want to, anything you're willing to pay for, Time Warner will put in for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that is the way that is.
They've got their new 50 megabit down. I think it's 50 down and 5 up.
Yeah, right. Well, 5 up would certainly be what you need.
This is a small nonprofit, so I'm not sure.
Right. Well, unless you can get them to donate, you're never going to get 10.
Yeah,
you're never going to get 10 streams on a standard. It's just not going to. It's not going to happen. It's going to be very sluggish, very slow. It's going to look like slow scan TV.
Okay. Well, I think you've given me the answers, guys. Thanks for all you do.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
Something to start with and look at least.
Oh yeah, he can play around with it. But like I say, at least he's not going to be under the wrong assumption of assuming that it's going to be super fast because. Right.
Well, but that's true of no matter what he uses in terms of whether it's Ustream or some other product, he's not going to get 10 streams up on that on standard Roadrunner.
No,
he's
not going to be able to do it. It is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And being nonprofit, that's even going to make it a little harder.
Right.
I'm trying to find the name. This Week in Tech with Leo Laporte, they give it a big thing on their streaming system, and they do live streaming over the internet. It was the old New Tech Video Toaster, and I can't remember the new name of it now. But it was like $50,000 for this box that takes all of their streams, and it can support tens of thousands of streams simultaneously.
Right, for a $50,000 box, and what's he paying a month in? Of course, he's not, I'm sure, paying a penny. But what would he have been paying
trade,
a month in?
And his internet costs, too.
Right. So, the problem becomes what you want to do is certainly
TriCaster,
doable,
that's the name
but
of
you
it.
Have to pay for it, simply, at least in bandwidth, if nothing else. All right. So I hate to give you that answer, but one stream, absolutely doable. If you were doing, for example, a Google Hangout or one of those sorts of things, you'd be okay. Oh, you stuck this on the outro.
It comes up wherever it comes up. I can't have it.
I guess. All right, we're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Listen to the nice music.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we've got Mike from Irondequoit on the line. Welcome, Mike. What's your question?
Hi, guys. The other day, I was playing a CD. I had it in the DVD drive, and the phone rang, and I put it on pause. I wanted to answer the phone, and something came up. I had to leave, and I was gone for about 7 hours before I came back, and I had it on pause the whole time. And I was wondering, does that in any way damage either the disk or the optical drive when you leave it on pause for that long a period of time?
No.
It shouldn't. No. It's not like the old VCRs where the read head was actually in contact with the tape. It's just the motor spins down and stops reading.
Okay, and the laser and all that powers down everything. It's just kind of like it just shuts down to save power.
Yeah, it just goes in hold mode.
Not necessarily. Well, I don't know if the whole unit would go into sleep mode. It depends if the unit itself has.
Well, as long as it's not spinning, the laser isn't going.
Yeah.
Okay, and it shuts down after so many minutes by itself, right?
If the device is set to do that.
Yeah.
Was this a computer or a standalone DVD player?
Oh, the computer.
Yeah, computers generally, you have energy saver controls where it will
go down and sleep.
Right. Yeah, it shouldn't be a problem at all.
Okay, there's usually three settings. You can sleep the screen, you can sleep the hard drive, and you can sleep the entire computer.
Just don't sleep the hard drive.
I've noticed with XP, if you try to put it in like a sleep mode or a hibernate mode, at least an older version of XP, they never seem to stay in hibernate. They always pop out.
Yeah, desktops don't like to go to sleep. They weren't really designed to go to sleep. And
laptops only.
Laptops are generally more designed that for saving battery life.
Okay.
So what you'll see a lot of is little things in the background are running all the time that wake up the computer again.
Right.
Like checking for updates, checking your clock settings. You know, checking for network access. There's a lot of little things that can wake up the desktops.
Right, right. Listen, I got one other question for you. When you're doing a security tangle, when you dump the Windows temp files, sometimes there's always a few in there that they're running in the background, and then there's one or two that never quite go away. I've been running the thing in sleep mode, and if you do that, if you dump the files in sleep mode, I mean not sleep mode, I mean safe mode. Where you have, basically all that stuff isn't running in the background, then it seems to clear everything up. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to do it that way?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not tempered. A problem at all. It'll work.
Okay.
Yeah, there's still temp files.
It simply doesn't matter. If there are some temp files that are actually being used, they're system temp files, and if they're in use, just leave them alone. If they're not, delete them. If they're still there, they'll go away next time or whatever.
Well, the thing of it is you boot it up in regular mode, and they're probably going to be recreated anyway. Right?
Yeah, right.
It's just in safe mode, some of the Tango programs can't run because they need full Windows mode.
Right.
But the ones that do run in safe mode are fine.
Okay.
Have you noticed the new look for the Security Tango page?
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, it's great.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
That should do the poll with that?
No.
You should do the
poll. I should do a poll with
next that. Week's poll. What do you think?
I'd rather keep it topical to something like that. But I think it's a better look. Things are not as confusing. It's a cleaner look. It's a newer look. And things just aren't
less
as confusing
is better.
As they used to be. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Thanks, Mike. Oh, I take it Mike is gone.
Yeah,
all right.
He said goodbye to us.
I redid the Tango. I got it. It's been looking ugly for a long time. And I thought, well, let's see what we can do to fix that. And so I put a new look up, and I think it looks cleaner.
Yeah, I still got to talk to you about the CD one. That's still not coming through. Or just put a note on there to tell folks to call us at the shop. Is that just no matter what we've done?
I don't know what to tell you about that.
Well like I say, we'll just post that they can call
when
the shop.
When I switch it to my name, they come through to me.
Yeah.
So they should be coming through to you.
I don't know why it's not.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I mean, well, maybe we can just change it to say just call the shop. Yeah, my shop, and we'll take care of it from there.
Yeah.
Sam can take all the information, and we'll gladly get it out. Because we've had a couple folks call and say, well, you know, I put that out. You know, I sent that request quite a long time ago, and you haven't gotten back to me. And it's like, sorry, I didn't get it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll just tell them to call the shop. I'll change the page.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
I have to remember to do that, but then I will do that.
I will send you an email.
Thank you.
I know what it's like. You know, you get so many things going, and it's like, shoot.
Do I have enough time for an email?
I
got plenty of time. Eastman Kodak Company, you may have heard of them, seeking to sell or license a portfolio of more than 1,100 patents, sued Apple and HTC in an expansion of a legal strategy that may help boost the value of its inventions to fund a turnaround. Two infringement lawsuits filed in federal court in Rochester, New York, maybe you've heard of it, accused the smartphone makers of using, without permission, Kodak technology for image transmission, including a way for users to share images directly from cameras.
Kodak also claims HTC is infringing an additional patent for a preview feature, which is at the center of a U.S. International Trade Commission case against Apple and Research in Motion. They're trying to generate value for their patent portfolio, said Ron Epstein, chief executive officer of patent brokerage Epicenter IP Group LLC in Redwood City, California. Kodak, predicted by analysis to report its fourth straight annual loss on January 26th, has put the company's digital imaging patents up for sale to help fund changes to its business. CEO Antonio Perez, who is betting on digital printers for publishers, packagers, advertisers, and households to lift Kodak, has said the Apple RIM Trade Commission case may generate $1 billion, that's billion with a B, in new revenue from settlements. Kodak did not say how much the new Apple and HTC cases would be worth. The company filed companion complaints at the Trade Commission the other day in Washington, seeking to block U.S. imports of products, including Apple's iPad and iPhone and HTC's Flyer tablet and Wildfire S phone that are made overseas. This is an important part of ongoing operations to get them through the transition. A bad sign would be them sitting on their hands and waiting for these to sell. The civil suits may be put on hold while the ITC conducts its investigations. The agency seeks to complete investigations in 16 to 18 months, though it's been forced to extend that target in many cases because of the deluge of litigation over mobile devices. So should Kodak play their patents off for cash? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. Kodak's in a tough place right now, And being able to sell off their patent portfolio, I guess you got to do something to stay afloat.
Yeah, because what they right now, I think they'll come off the stock exchange. They were saying if they don't get their stock up to $1 a share, and it has to be $1 a share for over a month, or they're going to be pulled from the stock.
Yeah, it was 51 cents a share yesterday, I think it was. Yeah, they were not doing great.
But it's
52 cents.
What's interesting is. A lot of Kodak's patents are on the original digital cameras, the photo compression algorithm, so they may have a standing in these lawsuits. The irony is that Kodak never capitalized on digital cameras until it was too late.
Mm-hmm. They were kind of the Xerox of their day with that
stuff. Yeah.
And so now all of these patents, they're suing everybody else for money, and while no one's buying Kodak cameras anymore.
Well, that's the thing. You know, film is no longer... You know, I mean, unless you're a professional photographer, you know, the digital cameras are getting to where you can do more.
They did. Kodak did announce a really cool, let me get back to the page I was here. They have a wireless camera announced at CES. A lot of new toys coming out at CES last
week. For uplinking to Twitter and Facebook.
And Facebook, yeah. Kodak wireless printers and really neat way now, and Kodak has always had really huge screens on their cameras.
Well, Kodak makes nice cameras. There's no question.
Well, they came out with the technology. It was a thin film display film that they came out, and Sony, I think, and them took it up. They sold it to them, but it was Kodak's development that came out of those thin displays that you see on the back of cameras and even on some cell phones. The technology originally started here at Kodak.
Right. One of the things that Kodak has always had to support it is the fact that so many movies used Kodak film. Now people are going to these RED cameras, the digital cameras, and the RED One, the Epic, the Scarlett 4K and 5Ks, and they're not using film anymore for any of that stuff. So it's a real Kodak is seeing its traditional markets go away, and they haven't. In my humble opinion, they haven't done enough to move into new markets.
Peter Jackson is using 48 RED cameras to film The Hobbit. He's doing it in 3D, so he has 24 pairs of cameras. He had a really, really cool video diary of how they're doing in this 3D stuff. I'll post a link for it.
Well, I remember many years back, it's over at Channel 13, they were showing me the hard drives that they use in their cameras now. Instead of using the old tapes, they were using these hard drives, and they were virtually indestructible. They said you could grab one of these hard drives and throw it down the hallway, bang against the wall, pick it up, put it back in the camera. It was still working.
That was the first digital cameras. You had this really nice, high zoom digital camera, and then a shoulder pack with the 10 meg hard drive in it at the time.
Yeah,
right. The RED One, which is the original RED camera, actually had five times the resolution of an HD video.
camera, and they're just and the Epic is more. And I mean, it's just it's ridiculous. 5K and the 4K and 5K cameras. They're beautiful cameras. We're seeing more and more movies shot with them, which means that a lot of Kodak's traditional markets are just disappearing. Yeah.
The Regal cinema in Eastview that I go to a lot, they have the Sony 4K cinema logo that shows up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find someone behind the scenes that knows if that really is a 4K cinema. What we've seen is that a lot of the digital movie theaters, when they shift from film to digital projection, they just get a 1080p projector. 1080p may be high resolution for your television, but it's very low resolution for your computer,
right?
And extremely low when it's broadcast on a 100-foot screen.
Yeah, right.
So that's where we're seeing 2K and 4K movies are just looking almost too real. We're into that uncanny valley on these movie screens.
The Uncanny Valley. Nice. Nice. All right. That music tells me that, sadly, 2 solid hours of your life have gone by that you will never get back. We want to thank you for having spent them with us. We will be back again to help you waste 2 more hours of your life next Saturday. So I want to thank Dave Enright and Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. And you have been listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. Stay tuned. George is coming in with the German show. Some of the best music you'll hear all day. And some of you will even understand what he says half the time because it's in German. But it's all happening right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. So you stay tuned and you keep listening all day long.